a gathering of homosexuals at the state capitol. With a bullhorn in hand, Romer said that if any state employees tried to enforce the measure, he would fire them. But Romer didn't need to carry out his threat. Amendment 2 never went into effect. It was challenged almost immediately, and its enactment was stopped by a Colorado state court. The case eventually reached the U.S. Supreme Court as Romer v. Evans. Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote the opinion for the majority of the court, which upheld the permanent injunction issued by the Colorado court against the amendment. Kennedy based his argument on the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, which was originally intended to protect the newly freed slaves after the Civil War. Equal protection of the law, it should be emphasized, does not mean that every law must treat each group of people the same. As Kennedy himself admitted, most legislation classifies for one purpose or another, with resulting disadvantage to various groups or persons. For this reason, laws challenged under the Equal Protection Clause are generally analyzed by the court under the rational basis test. The law must be reasonably related to a legitimate state purpose. If, however, the law affects a fundamental right, like voting, or a suspect class, like a racial minority, then the law is subject to the strict scrutiny test. It must be narrowly tailored to meet a compelling state interest. Kennedy dismissed the primary rationale for the amendment: freedom of association for landlords or employers who have objections to homosexual behavior. The reasons offered for the amendment, he wrote, were inexplicable by anything but animus toward the class it affects, and the amendment served no legitimate state interest. Justice Antonin Scalia, in his dissent, argued that Amendment 2 was merely an attempt by the people of Colorado to maintain traditional morality. This attempt was not only constitutional, it was specifically approved by Congress within federal statutes and the Supreme Court in the Bowers v. Hardwick decision. He noted how Kennedy and the other justices had ignored Bowers and instead imposed their own political sensibilities on Colorado. In holding that homosexuality cannot be singled out for disfavorable treatment, the court contradicts a decision, unchallenged here, pronounced only 10 years ago in Bowers v. Hardwick, and places the prestige of this institution behind the proposition that opposition to homosexuality is as reprehensible as racial or religious bias. Whether it is or not is precisely the cultural debate that gave rise to the Colorado Constitutional Amendment and to the preferential laws against which the amendment was directed. Since the Constitution of the United States says nothing about this subject, it is left to be resolved by normal democratic means, including the democratic adoption of provisions in state constitutions. This court has no business imposing upon all Americans the resolution favored by the elite class from which the members of this institution are selected, pronouncing that animosity toward homosexuality is evil. Scalia punctured the central thesis of the majority with the following observation: if it is constitutionally permissible for a state to make homosexual conduct criminal, surely it is constitutionally permissible for a state to enact other laws merely disfavoring homosexual conduct. And a fortiori, it is constitutionally permissible for a state to adopt a provision not even disfavoring homosexual conduct, but merely prohibiting all levels of state government from bestowing special protections upon homosexual conduct. He concluded, "Today's opinion has no foundation in American constitutional law, and barely pretends that striking Amendment 2 down is an act not of judicial judgment, but of political will." Of course, Scalia was right. How could Amendment 2 possibly be unconstitutional in light of the court's holding in Bowers? Kennedy understood this, and he, on behalf of a majority of the justices, would soon strike back by overruling Bowers, the case they couldn't square with their desired result in Romer. They seized on a case called Lawrence v. Texas. In 1998, a Texas sheriff's deputy responded to a report of a man going crazy with a gun. The deputy entered the suspect's apartment through the unlocked front door. Although he found no one with a gun, he saw John Lawrence and Tyron Garner engaging in anal sex. He arrested them for violation of Texas's sodomy statute, a Class C misdemeanor, and they spent the night in jail. Notably, the sodomy statute in Texas, unlike the Georgia statute, prohibited conduct between same-sex couples, but not different-sex couples. Lawrence and Garner were charged and convicted before a justice of the peace. Roger Nance, who had called in the complaint, was also arrested for filing a false police report, for which he spent 15 days in jail. After a new trial in criminal court, the convictions of Lawrence and Garner were upheld by the Texas Court of Appeals. The two men sought protection under the Equal Protection and Due Process Clauses of the 14th Amendment, as well as the repeal of Bowers. The U.S. Supreme Court took up the case, hearing oral argument in March 2003. The questions posed by the justices during oral argument revealed much about their thinking. The transcript shows Justice Stephen Breyer quoting a childish poem to mock the idea that a state could ban certain conduct simply because it didn't like it. He also badgered the lawyer representing Texas for trying to justify the sodomy statute. "You've not given a rational basis except to repeat the word morality," Breyer said, as if morality is an insufficient basis for law. Breyer summed up the main argument for overruling Bowers. It was not about sodomy per se, but that people in their own bedrooms have the right to do basically what they want if it's not hurting other people. This is wrong as a matter of law and fact. Before Lawrence was decided, Senator Rick Santorum of Pennsylvania provoked a firestorm of criticism in the media with his opinion about the case. "If the Supreme Court says that you have the right to consensual gay sex within your home, then you have the right to bigamy, you have the right to polygamy, you have the right to incest, you have the right to adultery, you have the right to anything," he said. "All of those things are antithetical to a healthy, stable, traditional family." Although Santorum was making an accurate prediction about the legal ramifications of overturning Bowers, he was denounced as a bigot who spreads lies. The New Republic stated, "It's hard to characterize Santorum's remarks as anything other than those of a homophobic bigot. But rest assured, Santorum's staff has tried." In June 2003, the U.S. Supreme Court's majority opinion in Lawrence overruled Bowers. Kennedy wrote the opinion for the majority, which was long on philosophy and short on precedent. Kennedy's opinion in Lawrence is a result in search of a rationale. He began with, "Liberty protects the person from unwarranted government intrusions into a dwelling or other private places." This statement means absolutely nothing from a constitutional perspective. Every criminal or immoral act can be justified on the grounds of exercising liberty. But Kennedy has a purpose in such an approach. By using the catch-all word liberty rather than applying the Constitution to the issue, he seeks to expand the plain meaning of the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, which prohibits the states from depriving any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, to grant rights not mentioned elsewhere in the Constitution. Kennedy and the majority explicitly overruled Bowers and wrote that Stevens' original reasoning in dissent that morality alone is not a legitimate basis to support a law was right. Scalia countered, "This effectively decrees the end of all morals legislation. If, as the court asserts, the promotion of majoritarian sexual morality is not even a legitimate state interest, no law against fornication, bigamy, adultery, adult incest, bestiality, and obscenity can survive rational basis review." Kennedy, traveling further and further away from his judicial responsibility to interpret the Constitution, wrote of an emerging awareness that liberty gives substantial protection to sexual decisions, and reviewed how sodomy laws had been repealed in most states, and even in Europe, where the European Court of Human Rights found sodomy laws invalid under the European Convention on Human Rights. Kennedy concluded with a lecture about liberty. The petitioners are entitled to respect for their private lives. The state cannot demean their existence or control their destiny by making their private sexual conduct a crime. Their right to liberty under the Due Process Clause gives them the full right to engage in their conduct without intervention of the government. The Texas statute furthers no legitimate state interest, which can justify its intrusion into the personal and private life of the individual. Justice O'Connor was faced with a problem. How could she vote with the majority in Lawrence when, 17 years earlier, she had voted with the majority in Bowers? She attempted to solve this dilemma with a laughable approach. She concurred in Lawrence's result, but provided a different rationale for her vote, arguing that the Texas sodomy statute, which prohibited same-sex sodomy but not heterosexual sodomy, violated the Equal Protection Clause. As Scalia wrote, the Texas statute could not possibly be a denial of equal protection, since it is precisely the same distinction regarding partner that is drawn in state laws prohibiting marriage with someone of the same sex, while permitting marriage with someone of the opposite sex. Scalia's conclusion describes how the Supreme Court has effectively set the terms for the gay marriage debate. He wrote, "Today's opinion dismantles the structure of constitutional law that has permitted a distinction to be made between heterosexual and homosexual unions, insofar as formal recognition in marriage is concerned. If moral disapprobation of homosexual conduct is no legitimate state interest for purposes of proscribing that conduct, and if, as the court coos, casting aside all pretense of neutrality, when sexuality finds overt expression in intimate conduct with another person, the conduct can be but one element in a personal bond that is more enduring. What justification could there possibly be for denying the benefits of marriage to homosexual couples, exercising the liberty protected by the Constitution? Surely not the encouragement of procreation, since the sterile and the elderly are allowed to marry. This case does not involve the issue of homosexual marriage only if one entertains the belief that principle and logic have nothing to do with the decisions of this court. Many will hope that, as the court comfortingly assures us, this is so." These three cases, Bowers, Romer, and Lawrence, demonstrate some undeniable and unpleasant facts that need to be considered if traditional marriage is to be preserved. The Supreme Court is clearly in the business of vetoing state and federal legislation by inventing new and increasingly more absurd justifications. It does not feel bound by the Constitution or even precedent. It is abandoning the constitutional framework that supports the moral foundation of our laws. In the future, statutes and even state constitutional provisions that uphold the public's moral consensus and traditions will be open to challenge. None of this was lost on the Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund, which saw Lawrence as the truly radical decision that it was. Lambda Legal will announce its aggressive plan for turning this landmark ruling into a reality in LGBT, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people's everyday lives. From couples and families to kids in school, we're sharing our vision of how this decision will touch every LGBT person in America, and we're sharing the Lambda Legal plan for making that happen. Celebrate our victory this week. Together, we're going to use it to win even greater equality for LGBT people for generations to come. Susan Sommer, a supervising attorney for the group, hailed the decision as an opportunity. "But even beyond what we can do with it, the Supreme Court's decision, technically as a legal precedent, which is quite a bit, it also simply changes the landscape, changes the culture, and reflects an enormous shift in this nation. The court has sent a very powerful message to courts around the land, to legislatures around the land, and to every community that gay men and women should be afforded the same dignities and liberties as everyone else. It is now a new day. Scalia and Sommer are right. The Supreme Court has set the stage for imposing gay marriage on every state under a distorted reading of the 14th Amendment. And the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts might have created the circumstances under which the U.S. Supreme Court could eventually act. In 2001, seven gay couples sued the Massachusetts Department of Public Health when they were denied marriage licenses. The couples claimed that they had a fundamental right under the Massachusetts Constitution to pick the spouse of their choice. Therefore, they argued, the Massachusetts marriage statutes could not be interpreted to exclude same-sex couples. In November 2003, by a narrowly split vote of 4-3, the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts found that the denial of marriage to gay couples violated the Massachusetts Constitution. The court wrote, "Barred access to the protections, benefits, and obligations of civil marriage, a person who enters into an intimate, exclusive union with another of the same sex is arbitrarily deprived of membership in one of our community's most rewarding and cherished institutions. That exclusion is incompatible with the constitutional principles of respect for individual autonomy and equality under law." To rectify this supposed injustice, the Supreme Judicial Court changed the common law definition of civil marriage to mean the voluntary union of two persons as spouses to the exclusion of all others. While explaining their action, the court claimed that it would not be appropriate to strike down the existing marriage laws. Their concern rings hollow, considering that instead of striking them down, the court drastically changed a fundamental aspect of the state marriage laws. Moreover, the court explicitly adopted the approach taken by the Court of Appeal for Ontario, Canada, in a gay marriage case, by changing the common law definition. Not only did the court usurp the state legislature, but it looked beyond its own constitution to a foreign legal system for guidance. After it altered the definition of marriage that had existed in Massachusetts for centuries, the Supreme Judicial Court went a step further. The court gave the state legislature 180 days to take such action as it may deem appropriate in light of this opinion. The legislature was, in effect, given a deadline to fix the legal mess the court had created. The Massachusetts legislature scrambled to come up with a possible solution. An attempt by the legislature to protect traditional marriage through a constitutional amendment required longer than 180 days. The legislature decided to propose the enactment of civil union laws, which would provide many, if not all, of the benefits of marriage, except one, the name. By a quirk of the Massachusetts Constitution, each branch of the legislature, as well as the governor of the council, shall have authority to require the opinions of the justices of the Supreme Judicial Court upon important questions of law and upon solemn occasions. The Massachusetts Senate asked the court to consider if the civil union proposal was constitutional, to which the court responded in February 2004 with a forceful no. Central to its reasoning was the terminology of the bill. The bill's absolute prohibition of the use of the word marriage by spouses who are the same sex is more than semantic. The dissimilitude between the terms civil marriage and civil union is not innocuous. It is a considered choice of language that reflects a demonstrable assigning of same-sex, largely homosexual couples to second-class status. The bill would have the effect of maintaining and fostering a stigma of exclusion that the Constitution prohibits. It would deny to same-sex spouses only a status that is specially recognized in society and has significant social and other advantages. The Massachusetts Constitution, as was explained in the Goodridge opinion, does not permit such invidious discrimination, no matter how well-intentioned. Despite the opinion, the Massachusetts legislature was not deterred. It went ahead with a constitutional convention. It passed the civil union law and an amendment to the state constitution banning same-sex marriage. But the earliest it will appear on the ballot for ratification is 2006. Nevertheless, shortly after midnight on May 17, 2004, the end of the court's deadline to institute gay marriage, municipal clerks began handing out marriage licenses to same-sex couples in Massachusetts. As the Associated Press reported, as of Monday, Massachusetts joins the Netherlands, Belgium, and Canada's three most populous provinces as the only places worldwide where gays can marry. Four of seven justices of the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, with the stroke of a pen, abolished hundreds of years of tradition and law over the strong objections of the legislature. And as these activist justices undoubtedly intended, their ruling will have consequences well beyond their jurisdiction and Massachusetts's borders. Unfortunately, without federal intervention, the prospect of one state imposing gay marriage on other states is quite real. The Constitution requires each state to honor a sister state's public acts and judgments under the Full Faith and Credit Clause. If a gay couple marries in Massachusetts, what prevents them from moving to Alabama and demanding that their marriage be recognized there? The existing legal impediments to gay marriage nationally can be easily circumvented. For example, in 1996, Congress overwhelmingly passed the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, DOMA, which was signed into law by President Bill Clinton. Congress acted because of rumblings that Hawaii's state courts were going to recognize a constitutional right to gay marriage. The DOMA states, "No state, territory, or possession of the United States or Indian tribe shall be required to give effect to any public act, record, or judicial proceeding of any other state, territory, possession, or tribe respecting a relationship between persons of the same sex that is treated as a marriage under the laws of such other state, territory, possession, or tribe, or a right or claim arising from such relationship." In essence, a state does not have to honor a same-sex marriage performed in a sister state. 39 states have also passed equivalent versions of the DOMA, therefore refusing to recognize gay marriages performed elsewhere. In August 2004, Missouri became the fifth state to pass an amendment to its state constitution banning gay marriage. There are more constitutional amendment efforts underway in numerous other states. The possibility also exists that a state could argue, if challenged in court, that the recognition of gay marriage is not compelled by the Full Faith and Credit Clause because it goes against the public policy of the objecting state. Even heterosexual marriages have not been uniformly enforced in the United States. For example, the age of consent differs among the states, so some states declare a marriage from a sister state invalid if a spouse is too young. Yet all these legal obstacles to gay marriage will crumble before an activist U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Constitution is the highest law in the land, and the court routinely strikes down state and federal law and even state constitutional provisions by invoking the federal constitution. Given the Supreme Court's rulings in Lawrence and Romer, a homosexual couple could plausibly argue that denying recognition of their marriage would be a violation of the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. In fact, equality under the law was the cornerstone of the Massachusetts court's ruling. There are essentially two options available to the elected branches of government to prevent the judiciary from seizing the ultimate authority to define marriage: to amend the federal constitution, or for Congress to pass a law denying the federal courts jurisdiction to rule on this subject. A federal marriage amendment was put forth by Senator Wayne Allard and Representative Marilyn Musgrave, both Colorado Republicans. It stated, "Marriage in the United States shall consist only of the union of a man and a woman. Neither this Constitution nor the Constitution of any state shall be construed to require that marriage or the legal incidents thereof be conferred upon any union other than the union of a man and a woman." In February 2004, President Bush called for a constitutional amendment to protect traditional marriage. He noted that some activist judges and local officials have made an aggressive attempt to redefine marriage. Although he did not specifically mention it, he announced his support for an amendment that followed the Musgrave-Allard approach. A primary criticism of this approach, however, is that it violates the principles of federalism by defining marriage for the states. Senator John McCain, among others, said it was antithetical in every way to the core philosophy of Republicans. The procedure for amending the Constitution, however, apart from holding a constitutional convention, which no one endorses, requires the vote of two-thirds of both houses of Congress and then ratification by three-fourths of the states. The amendment process itself, involving all state legislatures and requiring a supermajority for passage, is federalism. On July 14, 2004, the Senate voted 50-48 against a procedural motion to bring the federal marriage amendment to the floor for a vote. A week later, House Republicans tried the alternative approach, limiting the court's jurisdiction to rule on marriage. Representative John Hostetler of Indiana sponsored the Marriage Protection Act, which would strip jurisdiction from all federal courts over the Defense of Marriage Act. The bill passed 233-194. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi of California derided the measure, citing Marbury v. Madison for the proposition that the judiciary has final say over the constitutionality of congressional acts. She said, "Subsequent decisions and the court's role as an equal branch strongly suggest that Congress cannot prohibit the court from determining the validity of a law in the first place." Hostetler countered, "Anyone who actually reads the Constitution and has a basic understanding of grammar and the English language in general can find the fact that the Constitution grants the Congress the authority." For now, the issue is stalled. Not a single state legislature has recognized homosexual marriage, and most states have taken steps to defend themselves against activist courts that would impose it. This issue, like few others, will determine whether Congress has the will finally to defend its constitutional role as the public's federal representative body. Chapter 6. Endorsing Racism. "You guys have been practicing discrimination for years. Now it is our turn." Justice Thurgood Marshall. Affirmative action has been around since the 1960s. In Executive Order 10925, President John Kennedy instructed federal contractors to take affirmative action to ensure that applicants are treated equally without regard to race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. Several years later, President Lyndon Johnson issued Executive Order 11246, which required government contractors to take affirmative steps to expand job opportunities for minorities. President Richard Nixon went even further. He ordered federal agencies to set up a national minority business enterprise contracting program. In his autobiography, Nixon wrote, "A good job is as basic and important a civil right as a good education. I felt that the plan," Labor Secretary George Shultz devised, "which would require such affirmative action by law, was both necessary and right. We would not impose quotas, but would require federal contractors to show affirmative action to meet the goals of increasing minority employment." The problem with affirmative action is that it invariably involves reverse discrimination. Discriminating against people because of their race is repugnant and unconstitutional. But remedying the wrong of past discrimination by inflicting new discrimination undermines the very principle of racial non-prejudice that is the professed goal of American law and public policy. The Bakke Case. Starting in the late 1960s, educational institutions began to establish affirmative action programs designed to increase minority enrollment. The first Supreme Court decision to directly address affirmative action in education was the landmark 1978 case, Regents of the University of California versus Bakke. Bakke involved the admissions program of the University of California at Davis's Medical School. Students applying to the school had to have a minimum 2.5 grade point average, and only 1 in 6 who met that minimum standard were invited for an interview. Applicants were given a total admission score that included their overall grade point average in science courses, graded interview score, medical college admission test, MCAT scores, and other criteria, including letters of recommendation and extracurricular activities. In 1973, a perfect score was 500 points. In 1974, it was increased to 600 points. There was, however, a special admissions program run by a separate admissions committee for minority group applicants, in which the 2.5 grade point average cutoff did not apply. When the medical class size was 50, 8 slots were reserved for minority candidates. Both numbers were doubled in 1973. Alan Bakke was a white male who applied to the medical school in 1973. His combined score was 468 out of 500. His application for admission was denied because it was late in the year, and the admissions program had ruled that any candidates who scored below a 470 would not be accepted. Bakke applied again the following year. This time, his application was early, and his combined score was 549 out of 600. He was placed on the waiting list, but ultimately rejected. In both years, candidates who had lower grade point averages, lower MCAT scores, and lower total combined scores than Bakke were admitted under the special admissions process. The issue presented to the Supreme Court in Bakke was whether the special admissions program violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment prohibits all state discrimination based on race without exception. The court has ruled that the 14th Amendment protects Celtic Irishmen, Chinese, Austrian resident aliens, Japanese, and Mexican Americans. It has said that Congress was intent upon establishing in the federal law a broader principle than would have been necessary simply to meet the particular and immediate plight of the newly freed Negro slaves. But what about Bakke, a white male who was denied admission to a state medical school because of a racially discriminatory policy? Wouldn't the 14th Amendment protect him? Not necessarily, because over the years the Supreme Court has taken the clear language of the 14th Amendment and twisted it into a pretzel. It has held that when a government entity makes a law that provides for a classification based on race, the law is subject to a type of judicial examination known as strict scrutiny. This is the highest level of scrutiny that a court can invoke when deciding whether a particular law is constitutional. In order to pass muster under a strict scrutiny analysis, such a law must be narrowly tailored to meet a compelling government interest. Laws that are subject to the strict scrutiny standard are, in most cases, overturned, because the burden falls on the government to show how and why the law serves a compelling state interest. California argued that its compelling state interest in the special admissions program was to 1. Increase minority representation in medicine, 2. Counter racial discrimination in society, 3. Increase the number of doctors in minority areas, and 4, reap the educational benefits of a more ethnically diverse student body. Justice Lewis Powell, who wrote the opinion for the majority of the court, dismissed the first justification, because it was discrimination for its own sake, which is prohibited by the Constitution. As to the second point, Powell conceded that the state has a recognized interest in remedying past discrimination. But the purpose of helping certain groups, whom the faculty of the Davis Medical School perceived as victims of societal discrimination, does not justify a classification that imposes disadvantages upon persons like respondent, Mr. Bakke, who bear no responsibility for whatever harm the beneficiaries of the special admissions program are thought to have suffered. As for the argument that minority physicians would practice in communities that are underserved, Powell concluded that the state had not demonstrated that it must prefer members of particular ethnic groups over all other individuals in order to promote better health care delivery to deprived citizens. Powell, however, found California's final argument persuasive, at least up to a point. He wrote that because promoting a diverse student body encourages speculation, experiment, and creation, it is a constitutionally permissible goal. But he wrote that diversity encompasses a far broader array of qualifications and characteristics, of which racial or ethnic origin is but a single, though important, element. Powell decided that since the special admissions program focused solely on ethnic diversity, it actually hindered diversity, and was therefore unconstitutional. He wrote, "In summary, it is evident that the Davis Special Admissions Program involves the use of an explicit racial classification never before countenanced by this court. It tells applicants who are not Negro, Asian, or Chicano that they are totally excluded from a specific percentage of the seats in an entering class. No matter how strong their qualifications, quantitative and extracurricular, including their own potential for contribution to educational diversity, they are never afforded the chance to compete with applicants from the preferred groups for the special admission seats. At the same time, the preferred applicants have the opportunity to compete for every seat in the class. Consequently, the court outlawed racial quotas, or the setting aside of a certain number of classroom seats exclusively for minorities. But proponents of affirmative action won a partial victory nevertheless, because admissions programs could in the future use racial classifications if they are narrowly tailored and are one of several factors in the attainment of a diverse student body. Although California lost, affirmative action survived. Bakke would have significant and lasting consequences. Powell's decision served as the touchstone for constitutional analysis of race-conscious admissions policies. Public and private universities across the nation modeled their own admissions programs on Powell's views. In 2003, the Supreme Court again took up the issue of affirmative action in education when it decided the cases of Grutter v. Bollinger and Gratz v. Bollinger. The cases involved admissions programs at the University of Michigan Law School and undergraduate school. In Grutter, Barbara Grutter applied for admission to the law school. She had a 3.8 grade point average and a score of 161 out of 180 on the law school admission test, LSAT. Grutter was initially placed on a waiting list for admission, but her application was subsequently rejected. She challenged the law school's admission policy, alleging that she was discriminated against because she was white. The law school's admissions procedures bore the stamp of the Bakke decision, referring to the educational benefits that diversity is designed to produce. The former dean of admissions testified that he did not direct his staff to admit a particular percentage or number of minority students, but rather to consider an applicant's race along with all other factors. He also testified that at the height of the admission season, he would frequently consult the so-called daily reports that kept track of the racial and ethnic composition of the class. He said he sought to ensure that a critical mass of underrepresented minority students would be reached so as to realize the educational benefits of a diverse student body. Another former dean of law school admissions testified that there was no number, percentage, or range of numbers or percentages sought by the school to reach what it deemed a critical mass of minority students. Against this backdrop, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, writing for a majority of the Supreme Court, concluded that we endorse Justice Powell's view in Bakke that student body diversity is a compelling state interest that can justify the use of race in university admissions. O'Connor stated that the law school program was sufficiently tailored to survive a strict scrutiny analysis, and wrote, attaining a diverse student body is at the heart of the law school's proper institutional mission. Diversity, according to O'Connor, promotes cross-racial understanding, helps to break down racial stereotypes, and enables students to better understand persons of different races. O'Connor next examined whether the school's policy was narrowly tailored to achieve the compelling interest. Unlike the special admissions program in Bakke, O'Connor concluded that the school's admission policy was sufficiently tailored and did not operate as a quota system. The policy is flexible enough to ensure that each applicant is evaluated as an individual and not in any way that makes an applicant's race or ethnicity the defining feature of his or her application. But she also placed a time constraint on race-conscious admissions policies. We are mindful, however, that a core purpose of the 14th Amendment was to do away with all governmentally imposed discrimination based on race. Accordingly, race-conscious admissions policies must be limited in time. This requirement reflects that racial classifications, however compelling their goals, are potentially so dangerous that they may be employed no more broadly than the interest demands. Enshrining a permanent justification for racial preferences would offend this fundamental equal protection principle. We see no reason to exempt race-conscious admissions programs from the requirement that all governmental use of race must have a logical endpoint. The law school, too, concludes that all race-conscious programs must have reasonable durational limits. O'Connor and the Supreme Court majority recommended periodic reviews in order to determine whether the race-conscious admission policy was still necessary in order to attain the goal of diversity. Of course, there's nothing in the 14th Amendment about different scrutiny tests, diversity, and all the other judicial creations designed to get around the clear prohibition against racial discrimination. Diversity had never been a constitutional basis for government-sanctioned racial discrimination. As Justice Antonin Scalia stated in his dissent, the educational benefit that the University of Michigan seeks to achieve by racial discrimination consists, according to the court, of cross-racial understanding and better preparation of students for an increasingly diverse workforce and society, all of which is necessary not only for work, but also for good citizenship. This is not, of course, an education benefit on which students will be graded on their law school transcript, works and plays well with others B+, or tested by the bar examiners. Question: describe in 500 words or less your cross-racial understanding. For it is a lesson of life rather than law. Essentially the same lesson taught to, or rather learned by, for it cannot be taught in the usual sense, people 3 feet shorter and 20 years younger than the full-grown adults at the University of Michigan Law School, in institutions ranging from Boy Scout troops to public school kindergartens. There is another point to make here, and Brian Fitzpatrick, a former Supreme Court law clerk, has made it. It is that many universities practicing affirmative action in their admissions programs, and justifying such programs under the rubric of diversity, actually work to segregate races within the institution, thereby defeating the very purpose they claim to pursue. For example, in 1999, Princeton University held a separate graduation ceremony for minorities. Certain universities have separate multicultural dormitories. These dorms allow members of minority groups to segregate themselves from the general student population. Even the University of Michigan, a party in Grutter, holds a separate graduation ceremony for black seniors. And as Samuel Issacharoff, a law professor at Columbia Law School, has stated, the commitment to diversity is not real. None of these universities has an affirmative action program for Christian fundamentalists, Muslims, Orthodox Jews, or any other group that has a distinct viewpoint. Diversity is just the clever label the court gives to reverse discrimination. Besides, Americans don't need government-orchestrated diversity. We are a racially and ethnically diverse populace, and are becoming more so every year. In 2004, the U.S. Census Bureau projected that America's Hispanic and Asian populations would triple over the next 50 years. By the year 2050, whites would represent half of the total population. 1 in 6 adopted children is racially different from his or her parents. In 2000, 1 in 15 marriages in the United States was interracial. This is up from 1 in 23 in 1990. More to the point, as a matter of law, O'Connor's decision fails her own stated requirement that the law school program be narrowly tailored to achieve the purported compelling government interest of diversity. As Chief Justice William Rehnquist argued in his dissent, any program that seeks a critical mass of underrepresented minority students is essentially a quota system. Rehnquist wrote, "From 1995 through 2000, the percentage of admitted applicants who were underrepresented minorities, African Americans, Native Americans, and Hispanics, closely tracked the percentage of individuals in the school's applicant pool who were from the same groups. For example, in 1995, when 9.7% of the applicant pool was African American, 9.4% of the admitted class was African American. By 2000, only 7.5% of the applicant pool was African American, and 7.3% of the admitted class was African American. This correlation is striking." Justice Clarence Thomas, in his dissent, pointed out the essential unfairness of the quota system. No one would argue that a university could set up a lower general admission standard and then impose heightened requirements only on black applicants. Similarly, a university may not maintain a high admission standard and grant exemptions to favored races. If the school wanted to encourage diversity, all it had to do, Thomas noted, was lower its admission standards. Thomas also repudiated Justice O'Connor's 25-year time limit on her decision, writing that the law school's current use of race violates the Equal Protection Clause, and that the Constitution means the same thing today as it will in 300 months. Apart from violating the 14th Amendment, as a practical matter, O'Connor's decision uses nebulous terms and applies subjective analysis that will predictably result in further litigation and inconsistent decisions. A companion case to Grutter v. Bollinger was Gratz v. Bollinger. In Gratz, the Supreme Court decided that the University of Michigan's undergraduate admissions program, which had a selection index, its preferred mislabeling of racial discrimination, failed the strict scrutiny analysis. The majority in Gratz found that the selection index was not narrowly tailored to meet the state's compelling interest to promote diversity, so it violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. The majority's reasoning is summarized best by Rehnquist. The current policy automatically distributes 20 points to every single applicant from an underrepresented minority group, as defined by the university. The only consideration that accompanies this distribution of points is a factual review of an application to determine whether an individual is a member of one of these minority groups. Moreover, unlike Justice Powell's example, where the race of a particular black applicant could be considered without being decisive, the automatic distribution of 20 points has the effect of making the factor of race decisive for virtually every minimally qualified, underrepresented minority applicant. While the court reached the right conclusion in Gratz, it did so by an overly convoluted reading of the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment is not about charts and indexes and statistics. The distinction the court finds between the Grutter and Gratz admissions programs are hyper-technical. The court seems to believe that government-sponsored racial discrimination is okay as long as it is done on an individual rather than a group basis. But where is that distinction in the Constitution? The fact that universities consider many factors in enrolling students is no excuse for including race among those factors. The 14th Amendment explicitly provides for equal protection of all races. Government-sponsored racial discrimination violates the Constitution. Reacting to recent court decisions, Ward Connerly, one of America's leading advocates for merit-based admissions policies, wrote, "Let it be said that when given a chance to complete the liberation of black Americans, on June 23, 2003, five justices consigned them to another generation, or perhaps a term of indefinite duration, of virtual enslavement to the past. Instead of being free to be just Americans, the court has entrapped American-born blacks in a seemingly inescapable web of being set apart from the rest of America, as well as prolonging the suspicion and stigmatization that is visited on the accomplishments of high achievers, who are perceived to benefit from diversity and affirmative action just because of their skin color." At various times in our history, the court has promoted slavery, segregation, and internment based on race and ethnicity. Today, it promotes reverse discrimination. Mark up yet another victory for judicial activism and a setback for the rule of law and individual liberty. Chapter 7. Citizenship Up for Grabs. The Constitution does not constitute us as platonic guardians, nor does it vest in this court the authority to strike down laws because they do not meet our standards of desirable social policy, wisdom, or common sense. We trespass on the assigned function of the political branches under our structure of limited and separated powers when we assume a policy-making role. Chief Justice Warren Burger, 1982. If there is one area of law that should be universally understood as being largely outside the purview of the Supreme Court's social engineering reach, it is immigration. Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution states that Congress shall have the power to establish an uniform rule of naturalization. That, however, is not how events have transpired. For the last several decades, the Supreme Court has effectively trampled on Congress's constitutionally mandated, separate and exclusive power, and taken upon itself the task of rewriting America's immigration laws. The court has abused its limited authority and has become, effectively, the architect of the rules governing not only how immigrants enter and remain in America, but whether those immigrants can avail themselves of social benefits that states and even Congress have sought to limit to U.S. citizens. Thanks to succeeding Supreme Courts, illegal immigrants, not legal immigrants, but aliens who have broken U.S. law to enter this country, are entitled to a public school education at the U.S. taxpayers' expense. The court has also ruled that, despite laws to the contrary, non-citizens who are legally in the United States can qualify for welfare, can seek tuition assistance to attend colleges and universities, and can take competitive civil service jobs and practice law. According to the Federation for American Immigration Reform, FAIR, FAIR, Arizona spends $1.3 billion each year on illegal immigration. The same FAIR study reported that every Arizonan essentially pays a $700 annual tax to support the direct costs of illegal immigration. The New York Times reported in 2002 that a wave of immigrants in the last 10 years, particularly in rural areas far from traditional immigration hubs, has left school districts across the country desperately short of people qualified to teach English. In fact, the number of students who have limited English skills has doubled to approximately 5 million in the last 10 years. Educating illegal immigrants in the public schools costs the states at least $7.4 billion annually, according to FAIR. California alone spends an estimated $2.2 billion annually to educate illegal immigrant children. And the Washington Times reported that hospitals near the U.S.-Mexican border spent in 2000 almost $190 million to treat illegal aliens and another $113 million in ambulance and follow-up fees. Before American independence, each of the 13 colonies developed its own immigration policies. Most of these policies were geared toward encouraging immigration from Europe to help alleviate severe labor shortages throughout the vast expanse of the colonial territories. Land grants and exemptions from taxes were popular enticements to immigrants to settle in the New World. However, most of the colonies also had laws in place to discourage certain types of immigrants, specifically Roman Catholics. Many of the colonies levied head taxes on ship captains for any Catholic they brought ashore. Certain colonies offered land grants and tax benefits only to Protestants. As a result, the majority of the early immigrants came from Protestant England and Germany. After 1776, the new Congress did not preempt the state's existing immigration and naturalization policies. The only modification to the status quo came in Article 4 of the Articles of Confederation, the forerunner to the Constitution, which provided that the citizens of each state were given the same privileges and immunities as citizens of every other state. But each state retained its own naturalization and immigration laws and standards. This arrangement created a de facto briar patch of policies and practices that inhibited commerce and limited America's potential role on the world stage. The problem was rectified at the Constitutional Convention in 1787. Article 1, Section 8 of the new Constitution gave Congress the power to establish an uniform rule of naturalization. The noted 19th-century Associate Justice of the Supreme Court and constitutional scholar Joseph Story spoke eloquently of the need for congressional oversight and exclusive jurisdiction over immigration. "The power of naturalization is, with great propriety, confided to Congress, since, if left to the states, they might naturalize foreigners upon very different and even upon opposite systems. And as the citizens of all the states have common privileges in all, it would thus be in the power of any one state to defeat the wholesome policy of all the others in regard to this most important subject. Congress alone can have power to pass uniform laws, obligatory on all the states, and thus to adopt a system which shall secure all of them against any dangerous results from the indiscriminate admission of foreigners to the right of citizenship upon their first landing on our shores. And accordingly, this power is exclusive in Congress." The first effort to control immigration and naturalization came with the Naturalization Act of 1790. When Congress set the residency requirement for U.S. citizenship at 2 years. In 1795, the requirement was increased to 5 years. The Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798 were dramatic attempts by Congress, then controlled by the Federalist Party of John Adams and Alexander Hamilton, to address both a national security threat and a political challenge to the Federalists' power. The first was the imminent threat of war with France, and the second was the trend of new immigrants to ally with the Republican Party, headed by Thomas Jefferson. Among the many things these acts did was criminalize criticism of the federal government, and increase the time an immigrant had to live in the United States before becoming a citizen from 5